Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hi, this is Nature Now with Mary Robson and Charlie Fleischman today. This is true fall weather, even as we hope for more rain. And a good news report. King salmon have been spotted in the Upper Elwha River. That is wonderful news. And, as usual, our mystery sound. You're likely to hear this more often in spring. Here are some observations. Charlie will join me for these. We will be listening to Bob Steelquist talk to us about oceans in his interview with Ken Wilson. We have a couple of observations that connect with the ocean. The first is World Octopus Day, Sunday, October 8th. So I am just making this whole week Octopus Week. Locally, we grow the large Pacific octopus, with some adults weighing over 100 pounds, with an arm spread of 14 feet, though many specimens are smaller. Intelligent, they have millions of neurons located in their brains and their arms. Three-fifths of an octopus neurons are in the arms. They are notoriously hard to keep in tanks during captivity. Because they're boneless, of course, a large octopus can slip through a hole the size of an orange. They squirt water at caretakers they dislike, and one aquarium tucks their food inside a Mr. Potato Head, which they have to open. Okay.
Spiderweb. Spiders live here year-round, but in autumn, we notice the intricate orb web. It's vertical and nearly geometric, often photographed sparkling with dew or rain. Spider webs are rain resistant. The appearance of the orb web means that spiders hatched in early summer have matured to build them. Only about 25% of spiders produce such an artful web. They use at least two kinds of web extruded by their spinnerets. A framework of non-sticky webbing allows the spider to move around it. Sticky webs capture prey. When you bump into a spider web, you know the feeling of the web clinging.
More reasons to appreciate science and scientists. Arrivals from the sea. Since the earthquake in Japan in March 2011, large and small debris has washed up on Pacific coast shores. This causes alarm among marine life experts because within the flotsam, nearly 300 species of marine life clung to land here. The earthquake and tsunami initially caused the floating trash, but the durability of fiberglass and plastic allowed journeying all the way across the Pacific. Previous wreckage, like a sunk boat, wood and plant fiber would disintegrate or sink. Crossing the ocean took more time than the life cycle of many of these animals. Because the substrate stayed stable, the marine life was able to reproduce through several generations while moving east. Marine scientists from the Aleutians south to Lower California are considering the possibility of invasive organisms establishing populations. Some will disappear. Others may not have been detected as yet. One researcher called it a game of ecological roulette. And we will start our interview with Ken Wilson interviewing Bob Steelquist on the wonderful subject of ocean.
I'm Ken Wilson. I'm here for a second recording session with Robert Steelquist, who is just a fascinating and extremely knowledgeable naturalist, scientist, educator, who also cares deeply about the marine environment, and we're very fortunate to have him here. We're going to be talking a lot about the ocean. I've had the experience myself of being tens of miles or even hundreds of miles out at sea. And so I know that in my own life, when I've had that opportunity, there's this unusual and really satisfying gut feeling I get that's difficult to put into words. So, Bob, what is it about the ocean, and maybe even what is it that gives people this connection to it?
The ocean occupies over 70% of our planet. it's a dominant part of what makes life habitable on our planet. You're right. Something really clicks. You think of a carload of kids headed to the beach. When are we going to get there? When are we going to get there? Pile out of the car. They race down the trail. They get to the beach, and they're at the beach. And then you think about the rest of us. What is it that draws us to the ocean? What begins to click? Something really clicks in us. Part of it may be that we just look at the ocean as being the best example of something vast. It just overpowers us in scale. We know that it's an important component of even the continents, the shorelines. The ocean produces the sedimentary beds that plate tectonics push ashore that become land and mountains. The Himalayas are old ocean floor. We also know that as much as the ocean is a creator of land, it's a destroyer of land. We look at erosion. We look at eroded headlands. We look at sand particles traveling along the coast and becoming beaches and spits. And so we know the ocean is very important in physically shaping.
Yeah.
The ocean is the birthplace of life as we know it. And every time we step to a tide pool and begin this curious fascination with the things that we find there, we're realizing that what we see, as bizarre as its shape is, as strange as its behavior, it is some way connected to us. There is DNA in that organism that resides within us.
So at an intellectual level, of course, we know all that, or you know all that. And then I want to hit upon two things related to the ocean. One is, I've had the feeling, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, of being on top of the surface of the ocean, and I was searching for words to describe that experience, and I'd like you to do that for how it feels for you. But also, you've been beneath the surface in a submersible, and tell us about being above and also below the surface.
Well, when we first look at the ocean, our gaze goes to the horizon, and we scan north and south or east and west, whichever the way the coast is oriented. But we see this big boundary between sky and sea. We're astonished by the simplicity. The composition of this picture is very simple. It's a line with two zones. When we actually break that membrane, when we're actually able to descend, we begin to see that there are landforms, and notice I said landforms, underneath. There is a terrain below the ocean surface. We begin to see that there are communities of things that are covering the bottom, that are living things. They're active. There are schools of fish. There are seaweeds. There are things that we don't see in the intertidal zone. We certainly don't see on land. Even the very, very density of water, one of the surprising things when you're in the ocean and off of our coast is you realize it's like minestrone soup. It's filled with stuff. We call it marine snow. It's detritus. It's debris. It's living things squiggling around that actually can be limiting to our visibility. The notion that the ocean is this vast plain, emptiness, place of solitude and seabird cries really gets blown away when you are beneath the surface.
Yeah.
You mentioned the submersible. I had the good fortune to be trained to pilot.
Very good fortune.
to dive the Deep Worker submersible, a one-person sub. This was a project with Dr. Sylvie Earle in the late 90s. We dove in Puget Sound as part of our training and then dove off the Washington coast. I had a remarkable dive off of Cape Olava on the outside of the Washington coast.
To what depth?
We went to about 200 feet.
Is it light down there or completely dark?
It gets dark pretty fast. At 300 feet, it's pretty black down there. And I had one experience at 300 feet near Cape Flattery where I did shut off the lights just to experience that darkness. It's pretty eerie. It's about as dark as it gets. As Groucho Marx would say, as dark as the inside of a dog. It was a remarkable experience. But the thing that struck me was that it's an environment teeming with life. It's very complex. There are things going on there that you really have to pay attention to understand. And of course, it's unlike any experience we could have, perhaps except immersing ourselves in a tropical rainforest with all the things that happen there.
Right. Now, when you mention teeming with life, obviously across the planet, not all marine waters are teeming with life. What factors influence the abundance or even the diversity of sea life that we encounter in different parts of the world?
Well, let me speak to the Pacific Northwest specifically. The temperate Northeast Pacific Ocean is one of the most productive marine environments on the planet. And really one of the things that drives that is a combination of physical forces and biological forces. So let's break it down a little bit. As the Earth spins, it creates an effect called the Coriolis effect. During the summer season, when sunlight is brightest, the Coriolis effect influences the nearshore waters by drawing them offshore. So surface waters that are warm get pulled offshore just by the rotation of the Earth. And what water comes in to take its place is very cold. It's creeping up the margin of the continental shelf. It's coming up the submarine canyons. It's very cold, and it's bringing with it nutrients that have settled in the ocean abyss. It's bringing with it decayed living matter, and it's bringing that right up into the photic zone where the light is, and then it produces this explosion of life in phytoplankton. We call this upwelling, coastal upwelling specifically. So we get this extreme bloom during right. these sunny periods.
So on average, gravity causes it to sink, and as it sinks, it gets further and further from the sunlight. So something has to bring that stuff from the bottom to the surface, and that's what we call upwelling?
Coastal upwelling. Here close to Port Townsend, we have an upwelling in Puget Sound caused by sills, the Admiralty Sill right off of Point Wilson. Is water tumbling down and being brought to the surface. So we get these bursts of upwelling that are very localized.
Right.
But coastal upwelling is really driven by that much bigger process of surface water being pushed offshore and the space that it occupied being filled with cold, nutrient-rich water that feeds phytoplankton all the way up to us.
Talk about that in the context of what the productivity is, the abundance is in nearshore areas versus deep ocean areas.
Nearshore areas also benefit from nutrients coming in from the land, some of which are excessive. For instance, septic tank leakage or stormwater or nutrients that flow off of developed areas, they can overload this system. In fact, in parts of Puget Sound, Hood Canal, we start to see kind of a dead zone where there's an overabundance and basically the oxygen is all used up in the decaying process. We're right. starting to see some of that in the outer coast as well, following some of these really intense upwelling periods. And not too far offshore, we see whole areas where there's just not enough oxygen because it's all being used by right. decaying right. material.
Sometimes I've heard biologists refer to the open ocean as a biological desert. To what extent is that accurate or an exaggeration?
Well, the open ocean isn't any one thing.
Okay.
The open ocean, it's not just like a big pool out there. There are parcels of water that are moving around, and they occur in large and small scales. And so those parcels of water vary in temperature, they vary in salinity. The ability they have to support life varies considerably. And so you get phenomenal schooling of bluefin tuna and things way out in the pelagic ocean.
Right.
These are very productive. They're extremely productive. The distribution of seabirds that we see, shearwaters are a good example, over the Pacific Ocean. Yes, they do flock to temperate upwelling systems, but they're also scattered throughout the ocean. So I think it's really a misnomer to regard the pelagic, the open ocean, as a desert or any one thing, because it's a very complex system.
One area that gets a lot of attention among ecologists is this area or habitat we call estuaries. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that. And also, because we do have several species of salmon, and one, the Chinook, grows so much bigger than the others. There's a connection between Chinook salmon and estuaries, is there? So maybe you can talk a little bit about estuaries.
Estuaries are these sort of meeting places. Fresh water, salt water blend in estuaries. These are embayments or fjords or areas where water's being held. In Washington State, we have Willapa Bay, Grays Harbor, and then we have this huge estuary. Technically, it is an estuary of Puget Sound and the Strait of Georgia. Combined, think of this as the Salish Sea. So estuaries are this kind of blending point. This is where the land and the ocean systems are intermingling. And so we have an exchange of tides. We have salinity changing on the tides. We have flood systems after large rain events, freshwater intrusions into the estuary. And at high tide and in high storm situations, we have saltwater intruding into the estuary.
And lots of nutrients coming in.
Lots of nutrients coming in. Sometimes for better or for worse. Estuaries also happen to be the place where commerce is conducted. This is where we put our oil refineries, our major ports, our seaports like Seattle.
Right.
So estuaries are also contested by people and development.
Yeah.
So estuaries become these really balancing points between all these ecological factors and all these human-induced factors that make them particularly vulnerable. They're very important to feeding lots of organisms. Chinook salmon in particular are, as you said, they're the largest. They were called king salmon or are called king salmon for a very good reason. They're huge. You know, we know we had Chinook in the Elwha River that were able to get to 90-100 pounds.
Wow.
Chinook salmon like very fast streams. They like the deeper currents. They build their reds or their egg nests in larger cobble. And one of the things that happens is that they leave the river system fairly early.
The river system has less food in general.
Correct. And so they begin to move into estuaries, and they begin the adjustment, what we call smoltification or becoming smolts. They begin that physiological process of transformation into a saltwater animal as opposed to a freshwater animal. They achieve that over about a year, where they will early on, they'll stay in the fresher tending water, move into the upper part of the estuary, recede up into more river influence habitats, wetlands, eelgrass beds. Then gradually, as they continue to grow and they feed in the estuary, they become bigger and larger and larger. And then eventually they have made a complete adaptation to living in salt water.
Right.
They flee, they leave, most of them head into the big ocean, and then they go out as marine organisms. They're schooling and eating zooplankton, in particular, out in the ocean. They come back into the estuary. Sometimes it's a cycle of 3 or 4 years. They come back into the estuary. They find their way into the bigger rivers and spawn. Eelgrass is very, very important in the estuaries of the Northwest as coho habitat. A lot of the emphasis in salmon recovery, even locally, has been to rebuild our estuaries, the Nisqually Estuary, even in places like Discovery Bay, where there's been restoration of small estuaries. These are very, very critical habitats for Chinook, as well as so many other organisms.
So the Chinook especially, and some of the other salmon species, but especially the Chinook, part of the reason why they get so huge is partly attributable to the extra time they spend in the estuary.
Yes, it is. They really are able to glean a lot of nutrients in the estuaries. We have some Chinook that hang around. We refer to those as a black mouth. They don't go as far in the ocean,
right.
But estuaries are really critical.
Now, you had mentioned very, very briefly developed areas, seaports or refineries. Of course, when it comes to undeveloped areas, on land we have federal lands with different designations, national parks, national wildlife refuges, national forests, wilderness areas. The list goes on and on. Bureau of Land Management, which we call BLM lands. Fewer of us know what the guiding management policies and restrictions are for even the federal lands on land, but at least we've heard of them. Marine waters also have some of these designations, don't they? And why don't you tell us about some of those?
Well, there's been a growing awareness over the last few decades of the importance of applying land management concepts to areas in the marine environment. And this has been carried out in places like Australia, in the United States, the National Marine Sanctuary Program, the Estuarine Research Reserves, and more recently in Washington, DNR, Department of Natural Resources, has its aquatic reserve system. This is basically a way of patterning certain land management practices and varying degrees of regulation, some not at all, but some heavily regulated.
You mean like where fishing might or might not be allowed?
Yes, or other human right. activities. And basically what we've done is we've collected up a basket, I would say, I use that metaphor, on land and in the water of very, very important habitats or ecosystem types. We have recognized the importance of certain types of places and really put boundaries around them and develop management strategies that are appropriate to their protection, but also to further understanding these as representative environments for broader environments that we can't really put boundaries around and protect.
Well, in our area, Washington State, what are some of these?
We've got the Northwest Straits, which was guided by a very grassroots, locally based initiative for developing priorities for management that would address problems that were more locally based. We have Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary off the coast of Washington, which is very large, encompasses almost an ecosystem scale of ecological processes, coastal processes. We have the aquatic reserves process operated by the state to identify some areas. Protection Island has an aquatic reserve around the island, and as we know, the island itself is protected as a national wildlife refuge. These areas are taking on more and more importance because we can't protect everything, but we have acknowledged that these are very productive or right. very important areas.
So how does science play a role in marine conservation?
Science is, to me, three big questions, especially in the marine environment. What's there? What is changing there? And then how do we make good decisions? Science informs all of those. So we have to have baseline, we have to understand trends, and then we have to make good decisions.
What are some of the imperatives that you see emerging from that science?
The science is telling us that change is afoot. Systems that we once considered stable or predictable are becoming unstable or unpredictable. We actually need to develop a form of science that's a little bit more responsive to rapid change. Now, we can't apply all the technologies and all the resources of, say, big ocean ship science
right.
to every place. But this becomes really important, and this begins to sort out different roles for different people. Conservation-minded volunteers can play a very important role by being eyes and ears
right.
on the day-to-day. We refer to this as citizen science. The Port Townsend Marine Science Center has a wonderful program of citizen science that allows people to actually be the eyes and ears. Now, what happens—
And it's enjoyable.
It is enjoyable. People that do it learn a lot and enjoy themselves, and they know they're doing something. Citizen scientists, being on the beach day to day, can see things happen, and they can alert agencies and other scientists to things that are changing that are maybe out of the normal. And then those scientists, those agencies can apply their resources once something has emerged as,
right.
as an issue.
Yeah.
And then later on, we can begin to make the decisions necessary if there's something we can do to correct the situation.
Okay. Well, let's finish with good news.
Good news.
Good news.
The environment has turned off a lot of people because it seems like it's all bad news. I think the best news is really the continual experience that we can have when we know what's happening out there, when we care about it, and we can enrich our lives daily with experiences of delight, of seeing things, of looking for things, and experiencing just the majesty of this world that we happen to live in. Those of us in the Northwest know why we live here. That majesty of that environment is part of it. Edward Abbey basically said that the best revenge against the despoilers was to live your life here and enjoy it and be out there, be among this. You will outlive the bastards, as he said.
Right, right. And you will arrange for me to go out in the submersible, I hope. Well,
I wish I had that power.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Bob.
Well, thank you.
This is a very small bird, a song sparrow. Song sparrows are continental, living from the Aleutian Islands all across Canada, the United States, into Mexico. They are inconspicuous, one of the little brown birds, until the male starts his spring song. Trills and double notes delivered with sweetness make the sparrow's song iconic for warming weather. Females are attracted to the male with the most variety in song. Fledglings learn to sing by listening to adults. The best songs indicate birds who learn and remember well. They live here year-round on a varied diet of berries and insects, and their breeding comes in spring with longer day lengths. The nest looks like what a child might draw, a circular cup with a hollowed center, built with grasses. This week I saw two song sparrows splashing in a bird bath during a rain shower. And now for some events. You can volunteer for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. There will be an orientation for new volunteers on Thursday, October 19th, from 2 to 4. Volunteering with the center is a great way to get involved in your community, meet new people, and take action to help the Salish Sea. Go to the Marine Science Center website, www.ptmsc.org, and click on Volunteer to find out more. This came in to us from Diane Quinn, the program director. On Friday, October 13th at 7 p.m., in the Cotton Building, there will be a movie screening sponsored by Jefferson Land Trust called Last Stand, The Vanishing Caribou Rainforest. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is joining the whole Audubon Council of Washington on October 14th, that's Saturday, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. It meets at the Jamestown Sklallam Tribal Center in Squim. Registration, agenda, and details are available now. Check with the website at www.opas.org. That's it for Nature Now today. We hope you have enjoyed this program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community. And we'd like to hear from you. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM, on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m., Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. And thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.